Now, you must have something that you certainly, those of you who live here certainly have learned the meaning of the word. You need savanot. Today, what I really want to attempt today is to give you some feeling for the text and hopefully begin with one of the first major ideas that are that is expressed by the Khuzri that marks him off from all of the other philosophers of Judaism. Now, last week we talked in brief about the king's conversation with the philosopher. Today we have to take a quick look at the Christian and then the Muslim. And I'm going to try and make it quick, and I'll tell you why. Once I taught Khuzri, I think I spent a month on the Christian, and maybe more. And then I had a great deal of regret. I mean, the Khuzri was supposed to teach you Judaism, not Christianity. I remember once one of the great lines of my career, and I want to get it down on tape. When I was rabbi in West Hempstead, I learned Shabbos afternoon, I learned the Sefer Sanhedrin. I learned Gemara Sanhedrin. I came to a point in Sanhedrin where there was something that was omitted by the censors, and already in the last 50 years it had been placed again into the Talmud, and it really was about the death, the murder of Yeshu, Christ. So I went through seven shiurim, week after week, seven shiurim, in which I discussed all of the places in Talmud where there are references to Christ, not too many of them. And more than that, is it true that we killed him? Isn't it true? Anyway, I noticed that week by week, the number of people coming to shul grew. By the time I came to the seventh shiur, the shul was jammed. And I couldn't help it. When I finished the shiur, I said, "For 7 weeks you've been coming for Christ's sake." Now start coming for God's sake.
Very good.
That was a good one, huh? Yeah. And it just came to me out of the blue. I think it was what you think. A shik ruach hakodesh.
Pure gold.
Huh?
Pure gold.
The point that I'm making is I don't want to spend too much time on the Christian and the Muslim because this is a class in Judaism. So we'll see how quickly I can take you through it. As far as the philosopher is concerned, the philosopher we discussed last week in brief, and we only need to discuss it briefly. He says there's no such thing as God having will or need us to do anything. He's not involved in the minutiae of this world. He's not aware. He's not concerned. He's not involved. And we described the philosopher's approach to God as the chief executive, to extent, who has been kicked upstairs, that he is so high and he's so great and he's so awesome and he's so frightening that he's so distant from this world and he can't really be involved with the nitty-gritty of what goes on in the face of this earth. But the man, by virtue of his intellect and his mind, is capable of achieving greatness. Greatness nearly to a point of sanctity and holiness. One can arrive at the conclusions that will paint for him a picture of what a moral human being is supposed to be, an ethical human being. Goodness, kindness, humility, all of the great things can come to man as a result of his intellect. And therefore, he tells the Khuzri, there can't be anything that God wants from you that you need to do. And of course he gives it a philosophical twist. If it would seem as though God needs you to do something, it means that God is lacking something. And you can't say about God that he's lacking anything, so therefore it can't be that he wants anything from you. That was, and what's important here of course is we also have to get our feeling for the text. Remember that we said that there are five major essays, and each major essay is divided by a sub-paragraph, and the paragraphs are numbered. The philosopher was number one. Now, if you take a look at number two, which in your text is on page 39, we're going to take you through a number of these paragraphs so you'll begin to get the feel of the flow of the sefer.
39?
Page 39. You see, if there's a number two,
yes.
Said to him the Khazari.
Ah.
Now, I have an even later translation. Somebody who I'm not there, I spent 2 days at somebody in Los Angeles. I spent 2 days at his house. I was invited to Los Angeles, I think it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, to be the speaker for Yom Yerushalayim. They had a citywide Yom Yerushalayim gathering, and you know, they go after us Yerushalmim to come out there and to speak for them. It was 36 hours, I think, back and forth. And a fellow by Daniel Karabkin, I stayed at his house, and he translated the Khuzari. I have his translation. Here you can immediately see the difference, and he has very nice footnotes. He explains some places that are difficult to understand, but I'll keep you on the straight and narrow. You can see the difference already in style. Here it says, said to him the Khazari. And he says plain, the Khuzari said it. Understand? Okay. There's differences in style. Anyway, it said to him, the Khazari, thy words are convincing and yet do not correspond to what I wish to find. He says to the philosopher, I hear everything that you're saying. However, you cannot satisfy my needs because I know that my intentions are good. I want to do the right thing. I am a moral and an ethical individual. But I keep getting this incessant and recurring dream that says you're a fine human being. However, while your intentions are good, your deeds are not. The message that I'm getting is that there are certain prescribed deeds that God wants me to do. He says, I know already that my soul is pure and that my actions are calculated to gain the favor of God. To all this I received the answer, despite the fact that I'm really good, that this way of action does not find favor, though the intention does. My intention is okay, but not my actions. There must no doubt be a way of acting pleasing by its very nature, but not through the medium of intentions. There has to be more than a good heart. God doesn't want just a good Khazari heart. He wants something that reflects action. If this not be so, why then do Christians and Muslims who divide the inhabited world between them fight with one another, each of them serving his God with pure intention, living either as monks or hermits, fasting and praying? Obviously, you know what he's really saying over here? What he's really saying over here is that most of the world are not philosophers. The overwhelming majority of people in the world are either Christians or Muslims, and they both seem to feel, though they are a great loggerheads with one another, they seem to feel that there is an action or mitzvot that God wants us to fulfill. The fact is, what he's really doing here is he's using something that at first glance may seem to be not terribly intellectual. He's saying most of the world disagrees with you. Now, what does that mean, most of the world disagrees with you? Most of the world disagrees with us. Does that mean that we're wrong? What he means is he's referring to something that Aristotle said, that there are certain things that become established as truisms in the world by virtue of the fact that there are so many people who believe it. Now that means the following. It does not therefore mean that, well, either Christianity is right or Islam is right, because they're at loggerheads with one another. But there's one thing that they all agree. They all agree that good intentions are not enough. In other words, there's a certain truism that emerges from the totality of the world. There may be hundreds of different shades of Christianity and all sorts of Muslims, Shiite, Sunni, Ba'ath, I don't know all the
all various Muslim gradations. So therefore, there's no way of saying Christianity is right or Islam is right, or for that matter, that Judaism is wrong because we're the smallest people on the face of this earth. Because that already is going to bring us into a different question. But what he's saying is, he's really referring to something that this philosopher would understand, that Aristotle said, yes, there's such a thing as, you have a whole world, or most of the world, has this basic understanding that there's something that you have to do, that God wants man to act. If this not be so, why then the Christians and Muslims who divide the inhabited world between them and fight with one another? Each of them, their intentions are all good. Living either as monks or hermits, fasting or praying, for all that they vie with each other in committing murders, believing that this is the most pious work and brings them near to God. He's getting a little old. It says they believe so strongly that they're ready to kill one another. And by the way, this is being written about 1,000 years ago, 900 years ago. It's nothing new, as Maharadik Zich in the Welt. It's nothing new. They fight in the belief that paradise and eternal bliss will be their reward. Is that anything new to us? No. That's nothing new to us at all.
Missing something.
It is, however, impossible to agree with both. You can't agree with both, because in terms of what is the real religion, so there's, you have two conflicting ideologies. But one thing is certain. They all believe, and they're ready to kill for it, that they believe that there is something that God wants of us. That's the point that he's making to the philosopher. The philosopher replied, "And Mamish, this sounds like a left-wing intellectual. The philosopher's creed knows no manslaughter." By the way, when they say manslaughter, that's also not a good translation. They're opposed to murder. I mean, you understand? They're opposed to killing. They're men of peace. You understand? So I mean, shtoyach. Everybody's opposed to murder, as they only cultivate the intellect. The philosopher is only involved in the intellect. So he says, in number 4, Al-Khazari, the Khuzari, said to him, as far as you people are concerned, all of those push nooks in the rest of the world, hundreds of millions or billions of them, are all wrong. What could be more erroneous in the opinion of the philosophers than the belief that the world was created in 6 days? Remember, the philosophers believed that everything was here all along. There was no act of creation, or that the prime cause spoke with mortals. They don't believe that God communicates with men, because God is so exalted and so high, he's not going to deign to consult with mortals. Now, for each thing that he says here, you're going to get an indication of what it is that he's going to say ultimately about Judaism. The idea of creation in great measure is going to be fundamental to Judaism. More fundamental to Judaism is that God communicates with men. That God communicates with men. We'll go further. Not to mention the philosophic doctrine which declares the former to be above knowing details. God is beyond the small stuff. What is it? Don't sweat the small stuff. Is that the name of the book?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. As far as the Rebbeinu is concerned, that small stuff, what man thinks or what man does. Yes. In other words, it means, therefore, that there's no reward and punishment, and therefore there are no mitzvot. There's nothing. In addition to this, one might expect the gift of prophecy. Here he is going to attack the flood. If you are able to achieve by virtue of your intellect a level of sanctity and greatness unparalleled, then we would have expected that there would be prophecy amongst you. There would be miracles that would be performed by philosophers. One might expect the gift of prophecy quite common among philosophers, considering their deeds, their knowledge, their researches after truth, their exertions, and their close connection with all things spiritual. Also, that wonders, miracles, and extraordinary things would be reported of them. We would hear about philosophers performing miracles. Aristotle I don't know, splitting the Mississippi. I don't know any Greek rivers.
That's okay, the Aegean. The Aegean Sea.
The Aegean Sea.
And they were
long ago on the Aegean. Now he says the fact that there hasn't been any report of such a thing. Nobody ever said it. It never appeared any place on the face of this earth as an indication that there is no prophecy by the philosophers. There are no doers of miracles. But this is quite clear something that is said about people, the people of religion. I mean, this is also something that is accepted clearly by the masses of people on the face of this earth. Yet we find that true visions are granted to persons who do not devote themselves to study or to the purification of their souls. Whereas the opposite is the case with those who strive after these things. The grace of philosophers who strive all the time for perfection and goodness, there are no prophets. There are no doers of miracles. This proves that the divine influence as well as the souls have a secret which is not identical with what thou sayest, O philosopher. In other words, with what you say. There has to be something else. It's missing. Something's missing. He's finished with the philosopher. His dream has told him that there must be action, mitzvot that God wants fulfilled. As far as the philosophers are concerned, there is no such thing. After this, the Khazari, the king, said to himself, I will ask the Christians and Muslims, since one of these persuasions is no doubt the God-pleasing one. As regards the Jews, I am satisfied that they are of low station, few in number, and generally despised. So he's not going to consider inviting a Jew to darken the halls of his palace. So he invited a Christian scholastic and put questions to him concerning the theory and practice of his faith. The scholastic replied, really the Christian. The Christian replied, I believe that all things are created, whilst the Creator is eternal, that he created the whole world in 6 days. All sounds familiar? That all mankind sprang from Adam and after him from Noah, to whom they traced themselves back. All this is going to be very important. That God takes care of the created beings and keeps in touch with man. There is hashgacha pratis, there is divine providence. That he shows wrath, pleasure, and compassion. That he speaks, appears, and reveals himself to his prophets and favored ones. That he dwells among those who please him. In short, I believe in all that is written in the Torah and the records of the children of Israel, which are undisputed, because they are generally known as lasting and have been revealed before a vast multitude. Having been revealed before a vast multitude is most probably going to be the single most important contribution that the Khuzari is going to make, certainly in his first treatise, in treatise number one. And you know, I can even begin to tell it to you now. The Khuzari is usually referred to the one who takes the historical approach. And this is unique to Judaism. The Rambam is, of course, the one who is going to take the philosophic approach of Aristotle, and he's going to attempt to reconcile Torah with Aristotle, or Aristotle with Torah, and of course there are certain places at which they must part company. But the Rambam sees that there's a great deal of wisdom in Aristotle, and therefore that philosophy has to have some kind of meaning for us, and certainly we cannot be faced with a problem that logic, philosophic logic, is in absolute collision. 22 years in Israel, the English doesn't have to be that
good. Yeah, that's the problem.
All right. In collision, he says that we cannot suffer that we are in collision. That's the Rambam. By the way, that was a very brief approach of the Rambam. Don't think that that's the totality of the Rambam. Then there are those who attempt to bring all sorts of proofs to the existence of God. And one of them is going to, the sheet that I gave you this morning, one of the sheets, is from Rabbeinu Bechaya, who wrote the Chovat HaLevavot, and there he deals with proofs of the existence of God, and I'm going to go through it with you. We'll see it in a moment. And there are all sorts of proofs of the existence of God. There are proofs from the orderliness of the world. Okay, we'll see them. Rav Yehuda HaLevi's main contribution in this section of the Kuzari is history. History. There were 600,000 males between the age of 20 and 60, together with those who were younger than 20 and those who were older than 60, and including women, there were 2 to 3 million people that stood at the foothills of Mount Sinai and heard God himself communicate. They heard it. They saw it. Now this becomes a fact of history by virtue of the fact that it is transmitted from generation to generation, and the fact that I receive that is as though I personally was there and witnessed it. All right. Now you're going to tell me that, well, Christians and Muslims also have all sorts of traditions, all sorts of traditions. And you can have a good number of Jews today. The Torah was never given at Sinai. How do you know it? It's a narrative. It's a narrative. You know, because we haven't found, if we find a piece of God's pottery at the foothills of Sinai and we carve and test it, then we see that if this is what God drinks from, then we can prove that it took place. Along comes a Yehuda HaLevi and says, no, there's no such thing. There's no such thing. There's something called a historical fact. And the proof behind it is the following. Let's take another possibility. What's the other possibility? That it was a hoax. One big lie. Few Jews got together in the Sinai Desert, or for that matter, it may very well have been some kind of a cafe in Cairo. Listen, guys. Let's tell our children and our grandchildren that we were at the foothills of Sinai, and one gray, thunderous morning, God appeared to us and said, I am God, your God. You got it? Let's go over it. Let's get all the details right so we don't slip up. And they create this awesome fiction about Jews having been in Egypt, and that they spent 40 years in the desert, and mum came down every day, and water came out of a rock. A really elaborate hoax of the most profound order. You got it? You got the story we're going to tell our kids? Got it. Rav Yehuda HaLevi says, and we know it all, he doesn't have to say it, there's no way in the world that it would last more than 24 hours. There's no way that you could pull a hoax of that sort, a historic hoax of 3,500 years. It just doesn't work. By the way, if it did work, why did Christianity have to say, have faith that Jesus returned after the crucifixion? He was crucified on Good Friday, and he returned on Easter Sunday. How do we know that happened? Faith. They don't even say that there in the cave where he had been buried, the 12 disciples were there, and they were in the middle of saying Kaddish for the soul of Yeshu. And then he taps them on the shoulder and says, fellas, say it not Kaddish over with me, because I have risen from the dead. If you can pull a hoax like that, why didn't Christianity or any other religion try it? If you can pull off a story that is believed by Jews, and one thing we've never been accused of, I think, until now, we've never been accused of being a foolish and dumb people. now I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
That's already, that belongs to politics, that doesn't belong to the Qusri, even though the Qusri would agree with me 100%, and I will ultimately prove that as opposed to the Qusri. It means there are events that take on a life of their own only because they happened. There is information about events that is transmitted from generation to generation only because it's the absolute truth. If it wouldn't be the truth, it would never survive. A hoax is always going to be found out. I mean, how many hoaxes have we had in the course of our lifetime? You remember some of them?
The Hitler diaries.
The Hitler diaries.
Oh, that's good.
That was one.
Protocols.
The Protocols and Elders of Zion, half the world or three quarters still believes it's true. We're not finished with that yet. Okay? I don't know. I remember reading that, but this was in the early part of the last century. Pilltown Man.
Oh, yeah. Right?
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And there were all sorts of other missing links that were found, and then you found out it was the bone of a kachka, it was the bone of a horse. Hoaxes, nevertheless, they never take on the life of history. How does an event, do I have to ask somebody, there was a Second World War? Prove to me that there was a Second World War. Can you imagine anybody saying that?
There are deniers, and I hope.
Holocaust.
So the point, of course, is what will happen in the longer view of history? Do you think the Holocaust will remain as historic fact, or the deniers are the ones that are going to win the day? So I tell you here, it's December 17th, 2003, and I have great charata that I can't... Oh, I can figure out the Hebrew date. I shouldn't say Shabbos is going to be Chaf Hei Kislev, so we're a few days before Chaf Hei Kislev, Tavshin Samach Daled. The Holocaust deniers will simply not have the last word in history, because they're the ones who are denying history. That's the... When you're living in the midst of it, you think, those are the Hitler diaries. No such thing. Nothing lasts unless it's absolute truth. It just doesn't work. This is an idea that's going to be developed by Rav Yehuda Halevi. You know what it means? According to him, he doesn't need any kind of proof of the existence of God. You have to prove to me that God exists when we heard him speaking to us. You know what a revolution the Qusri therefore becomes? I don't need philosophical proofs. I don't need theological proofs. I don't need ontological proofs. I don't need anything. Something that I've experienced, and it's only because we experienced it that it was able to become a historic fact. That's what happened. This, therefore, is what is described as the unique contribution of Rav Yehuda Halevi, because this is a purely Jewish approach. The Rambam is dealing with Aristotelian philosophy. Other of the great thinkers of Yadud begin to bring proofs of the existence of God, so they're really doing St. Ignatius, Loyola, all of them wrote books about proofs for the existence of God. Now here, let's take a look, the famous one of Rabbeinu Bachya. You have a sheet that says on the top, Shar HaYichud,
yes.
Shar HaYichud, Perek Vav. There's a second side which is Perek Zion. Go to the side that's Perek Vav. Can you look here in my direction?
Yeah, we have it.
All right. We have both the Hebrew and the English here.
Yeah.
Here we are. The world has a designer. There are men who say that the world came into existence by chance, without a creator who caused it and formed it. See that?
Yes.
All right. There are men who say that the world came into existence by chance without a creator who caused it and formed it. I find this rather astonishing. No, that's really the position of philosophers. Those who say that the world was always here, that means it came into being all on its own. Thomas Alvarez says, I find this rather astonishing. How could any rational human being in his right mind entertain such a notion? If one held such a view, were to hear someone make a similar claim about a revolving water wheel. You know a revolving water wheel? They used to move water with a revolving water wheel. So he says, if you'd be talking to a philosopher or somebody who denies creation, and you're standing and you're watching this water wheel that was used to irrigate a section of a field or garden, and person one is going to say to person two that it came about without the design of a craftsman who invested effort in putting it together, constructing it, and supplying all its parts so that it performed its intended function. If I would say this to a philosopher, or whatever I would say to a philosopher, I don't know, this computer, this car, you see this car? This car came into being all by itself. You know what the fellow would say? You're on the sugar now. You're out of your mind. This is the same person who believes that the world came into being all on its own. A water wheel or a car, that's different. That can't come into being on its own. He would be amazed by such a statement. Speak slightingly of the one who made it, consider him a total ignoramus, and be quick to expose him and reject his claim. And that's then, you can hear it every so often. I hear it in interviews on the radio. He has to make it clear, make a statement. You know, I don't believe him. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in God. So where did it all come from? I mean, he doesn't think beyond that. He doesn't believe in God because he doesn't want to be burdened by Torah and mitzvahs. What do you mean you don't believe in God? What are you talking about? And there's no such thing. Who said that there are no atheists in foxholes? It's nonsense. Right. There's no such thing. You can ask somebody, how did it all come into being? These are quite basic approaches. And be quick to expose him and reject his claim. Now, if such a claim is rejected when it is made about a petty and insignificant little water wheel, which can be made with limited skill and serves a small plot of land, how can one allow himself to make the same claim about the great celestial wheel? That's why he uses the wheel. Because the whole universe seems to be moving around like a wheel. If you can't make this claim about a little wheel, how are you going to make this claim about a massive, endless universe that it all came into being on its own? It's madness. What about the great celestial wheel which encompasses the entire earth and all of its creatures, which reflects an intelligence so awesome that its essence is beyond the grasp of all human understanding? The world is so complex. Came into being on its own. The human body is so awesome. A flower. It's beyond the grasp of all human, which serves the well-being of the entire earth and everything. How can you make such a claim? How can anyone say that it all came into being without the intent of a designer, without the planning of an omnipotent intelligence? The first paragraph at the top is most probably one of the most famous paragraphs in the Chovat HaLevavot. We all know that where there is no designer's intent, no trace of wisdom or proficiency will be found. Surely you would agree that if a man were accidentally to spill some ink onto a blank sheet of paper, it is impossible that it would take the shape of orderly writing and legible lines as are written with a pen. If a person were to show us a page of orderly writing that could only have been written with a pen, and say that the ink had spilled out onto the page and had on its own taken the shape of written characters, we would be quick to deny it to his face, as this could not have come about without a purposeful designer. this sheet of paper. I spilled ink on it and look what came of it. You'd never say that. It's madness. This is one of the classic proofs of the existence of God, because there's a clearly complex, orderly, awesome, indescribable universe. It happened by itself. It staggers the imagination that anybody should even consider anything of the sort. But I say, according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, I don't need any proofs of the existence of God. Zekeli, we saw him, we experienced him. It was not something that you can say, well, this was part of my imagination. I was hallucinating. 3 million people were hallucinating. And therefore, anybody who wants to break this down begins, of course, with what the Jews were never enslaved in Egypt. And if there were, there was a family there. I think it was Ben Gurion who said many years ago, maybe 600 people came out of Egypt, no 600,000. In other words, you go back, and what they attempt to do is to take that, which any intelligent person must see as a historic fact, and say, no, it didn't happen. Didn't happen. So this is going to be Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's approach. And in Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's approach, it's going to have, there are going to be a lot of conclusions that are going to be reached on that basis, which means, of course, that it is classic pure Judaism. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi doesn't borrow from philosophy or from any other form of thought. Yes, you look like you want to ask me a question.
There's a problem. You know, you talked about the Muslim philosophy and Christian philosophy, and the problem is that they have their mythos also, and say that they have.
And I answered that.
I don't
think
I got it.
I'll repeat it. That's okay. That's good, because I'll have to repeat it a few times. If one could conceivably pull a hoax, then why didn't Christianity say there were 12 people present when Christ came back to life? If you will listen to the radio, if you remember the radio in America, in Alta Rain, you always heard, this is a principle of faith. We believe that he came back to life. Nobody was present, nobody saw it. But wait a minute. They already knew of Judaism, they were all Jews. They knew that we had created the great myth of all, that 3 million people were present at the foothills of Sinai. I mean, that's a myth or a fantasy or a hoax that even becomes a little bit believable. Why didn't they say that there was one person present, and he came out and said, Jesus came back to life? They don't say it. You know why they don't say it? You know why they demand that it should be an act of faith? Because you can't pull a hoax. They're going to walk out into the streets of Yerushalayim, and they're going to say, the 12 of us were there in the cave, and Yeshua came back to life.
Yeah, is that so? Is that so?
Yeah? You were there? And you know, they start questioning. The hoax would simply fall apart within a matter of hours. It wouldn't last. It couldn't happen. Now, if you could, if a hoax is possible, at least makes things more believable. Don't be there. I saw with my own eyes that Jesus came back to life. They didn't do it because they knew it couldn't work.
I
see. Yes.
But
it's lasted 2,000 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Why
did
the hoax last for 2,000
years?
How about the hoax of Mary giving birth to a virgin?
Well, that's the hoax.
Oh,
her mother.
Sure.
Her mother was also a virgin.
Right.
Yeah. But they believed it.
Yeah. But remember,
yeah.
It's not a hoax. Because they didn't say that it's a historical fact. It's an act of faith. So I can have faith in anything for 2,000 years. They didn't say this that was a historical event. A historical event means something that you don't even ask whether it happened or it didn't happen. You don't ask, was there a Second World War? And if you do, you got a problem. Do we ask questions, was there a Napoleon? Why is it that we all know about Napoleon? Why is it that we all know about it? Because of Marlon Brando. We know about Napoleon.
involved in all about Napoleon because there was a Napoleon. That's all we know about. Yes.
But they did create a historical hoax that we were the ones that killed Yashka, although the world saw the Romans do it. We couldn't even have a marriage without doing it in secret. All right. They did have this hoax on the historical.
That's fine. I like that question. And I'm even thinking of answering it. Because it falls into the same category as the hoax of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Or the hoax of the wandering Jew. Yeah. There are certain ideas that are absolutely false, but are propelled by hatred. Yeah. And something that's propelled by hatred does not take intellect into consideration at all. So therefore, when you ask, but are they believe such and such? Yes, they believe in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. They believe that we killed Jesus. So remember, it's all that they believe we killed Jesus. And it's a lie. By the way, all you have to do is read the daily newspapers. There aren't lies that are being said about the Jewish people. Janine. When you create a hoax that people want to believe.
Yeah.
It serves their purpose to believe it. Then you know what? They are going to believe that hoax. They want to. You know what? They most probably even know that it's a lie too. In Tsarist Russia, when they wrote the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, I'm sure that the fellow who wrote it had an amazing imagination and knew that it was a lie, and it was being published and given out to the world in order to create or strengthen anti-Semitism. So people lie. In the political world, people don't lie. In private life, that people don't lie when they stand to gain something from it. It doesn't mean that this has taken on historical fact. It doesn't become historical fact. It may become historical hoax. It may become something that can be absolutely destructive, but nobody says that this is a fact. You'll get hold of the fellow who wrote the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Not shall he lie, but it was probably if he survived Lenin and Stalin killed him. All right. No, this was Tsarist Russia, Kreis, Tsar Nikolai. Yes.
Before you go on, could you please repeat who wrote this?
I knew you were going to ask that, but I didn't prepare it. Rhoda wants to know the biography of Rabbeinu Barkhia, the Chabal Cholot HaLevavos, and I humbly do my hand in Chovat HaLevavot, I'll bring you the information. The duties of the heart. Yeah, but the precise years of Rabbeinu Barkhia and Pekunda, I don't have it, you know. I knew when I walked out of the house this morning that I should have prepared. I knew this was going to happen. I was terrified that this would happen, and it did. So I'm saying, according to Yehuda HaLevi, his great contribution is we don't need any sophisticated or even non-sophisticated proofs of the existence of God. We don't need any proofs of that Torah is from Sinai. Torah from Sinai is a historic fact. And when you think about it, it's a very profound statement that's been made by Rabbi Dalek. I, of course, have always, certainly the last good number of years, I've been saying that there's no point, there's really no necessity anymore, there's no necessity anymore to prove that Torah is true. Because we're living through a very unique period, an exceptional period in Jewish history, when we see before our very eyes the fulfillment of prophecies that go back 2,000, 2,500 years. I just tell people, open up a Tanakh and there you have it. It's so clear, everything that was said all of these years. We are the living fulfillment of it. I don't need anybody to make any proofs of that. I don't need any proofs of the existence of God. I don't need any proofs for the truth of Torah. It's there. How many hundreds of psukim say that you're going to return from the north, the south, the east, and the west? How many are Jews here from 150 countries, 160 countries, unparalleled and unmatched in all of history, and people returning from all over the world to their ancestral land after an absence of 1900 years. This is unbelievable. Who needs proof? And I still, you know, in certain yeshivas and certain schools, they're still learning all of the complicated and uncomplicated proofs of the existence of God. We're in a Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi mode today. And by the way, that's why I feel that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi has become certainly extremely popular in the religious national Zionist camp. I mean, if we even read last week that Gretz refers to Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi as the great religious nationalist, the religious nationalist. And you're going to see that. He certainly is. I mean, he speaks to our generation. We're not post-Zionism, but we are certainly post-philosophy. In terms of questions of the existence of God and proof and all of this, we've passed that point. And the fellas who are still grappling with these issues are the ones who are living in the past. All right, let's go in. You know, I at least hopped that ring in the middle of the Christian. I gave you already the broader outline of what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to say. But here the Christian is talking. He said that we believe everything that it says in Torah and the records of the children of Israel, which are undisputed, because they are generally known as lasting. And I was really talking about the next few words, and have been revealed before a vast multitude. This is where he throws in what's going to become his great contribution. Subsequently, the divine essence became embodied in an embryo. Here we're going off to Christianity. What happened afterwards was the divine essence became embodied in an embryo in the womb of a virgin taken from the noblest ranks of Israelitish women. She bore him the semblance of a human being, but covering the divinity. It's just, this is one of those, this is one of those... This is one of those beautiful statements in Hebrew. In Hebrew, just one sentence over here. Let me see. Wait a minute, just one moment. I just have to find... No, sorry, of course.
Okay.
Adam benigla ve'eloha benistar. Before your eyes, you see a human being. But you know what's concealed within that human being? Is concealed the God. Yes, God. He is the Messiah, whom we call the Son of God, and he is the Father and the Son of the Holy Spirit. We condense his nature into one thing, even though we talk as though there are three. The three are one. We believe in him and in his abode among the children of Israel, granted to them as a distinction, because the divine influence never ceased to be attached to them until the masses rebelled against us. In other words, Jews were the chosen people until we rebelled against the Messiah and they crucified him. Then divine wrath burdened them over everlastingly, whilst the fatal was confined to a few. The title Children of Israel now goes from the multitude of the Jewish people to the few students of Yeshua. Whilst the fatal was confined to a few who followed the Messiah and to those nations which followed these few, we belong to their number. Although we are not of Israelite descent, we are well deserved of being called children of Israel because we follow the Messiah and his 12 Israelitish companions who took the place of the Christ. Now you see what they did try. They tried to piggyback on the Jewish people. So that's why if you have 12 disciples, 12 is a good number. By the way, the first 24 sentences of the New Testament begin with the genealogy of Jesus straight back to King David. There's only one problem with it. He didn't have a father. How can you I'll have to trace it back to King
David.
It's unbelievable.
Miraculous.
The opening 24 sentences of the New Testament are clearly an absolute unadulterated lie. Once discussed it with a priest many, many years ago. He said, listen, you have to understand that the only kind of royalty that could be by the Jewish people was from the house of David. So they had to find a genealogy. What he's really saying is, yeah, I got a big problem to try and explain that.
Should have told Mary.
That's a very, very serious...
Was he a Catholic?
It's a long, long time.
No, he probably wasn't a Shuman.
Many Israelites followed these 12 and became the leaven, as it were, for the Christians, the Seor, the yeast from which came the Christians. We are worthy of the degree of the children of Israel. To us was also granted victory and expansion over the countries. There's nothing like success. All nations are invited to this religion and charged to practice it, to adore the Messiah and the cross on which he was put and the like. Our laws and regulations are derived from the Apostle Simon. That was really Paul. He became Paul later. But I imagine the Kuzri doesn't want to call him by his English name, so he called him by his Jewish name. He was Shimon. I understand. Shimon is a Shimon. All right? And from ordinations taken from the Torah, which we study, its truth is indisputable, as is also the fact that it came from God. It is also stated in the New Testament, I cometh not as to destroy one of the laws of Moses, but I came to confirm and enlarge it. All right. Okay, finished. Took care of Christianity. And then said the Khazari, I see here no logical conclusion. Nay, logic rejects most of what you say. If both appearance and experience are so palpable that they take hold of the whole heart, compelling belief is a thing of which one is not convinced. They render the matter more feasible by a semblance of life. Wasn't that a State Department English? Understand?
Yeah.
It's clearly there to confuse. Let me read it in the Khuzari said to the Christian, I'm reading it from another text. Logic plays no part in your argument. If anything, logic dictates the exact opposite. When it comes to things illogical, the only way a person will be convinced is by seeing something firsthand.
Firsthand. That's what it is.
If something is illogical, the only way that I will be able to believe it is if I see it.
Right, that's what you said.
When a person sees something with his own eyes, do you see how he is injecting into the words of response to the Christian, as in the words of the Christian, what is going to become the position of the Rav Yehuda Halevi with regard to Judaism? When a person sees something with his own eyes, he has no choice but to accept the phenomenon as true, despite its illogic. God descends from the heavens, and his voice booms out from the top of Sinai, Oh, Melchi Hashem Elokecha, I am God your God, and took you out of the land of Egypt. It's illogical, but I'm experiencing it. That the sea should split. Go tell somebody a story, the sea split. Sure, it's illogical. It defies human imagination. We can't imagine such a thing unless you see it. The individual is then forced to reconcile what he saw with logic and work out some logical explanation for the phenomenon. A good example of this is found with the empirical scientists. They develop their theories based on logic, and also dismiss various phenomena as being impossible based on logic. But something that the scientist, somebody shows the scientist in the lab that what you thought cannot be, there it is, take a look at it, it's happening. I mean, there must be thousands, tens of thousands of things that were ideas that were dismissed by scientists that it can't be done. And then comes another scientist, and he proves it can be done. And then when you see it before your very eyes, that it has been done. I don't know, there must have been those who thought you'll never be able to split the atom. Along came Einstein and said yes. And then not only did he say yes, It also happened in fact. So you know what it means? That everybody has to go back to the drawing boards, and that which they thought to be absolutely impossible and illogical, all of a sudden has become possible logical. My wife always tells me, if my father, Oliver Shaw, would see people walking around with a thing by their ears, and they're talking into it, he would say, this is how you should be now. So you can tell him, that's a cell phone. Without wires, cell, smell, smell, what are you doing? It can't be. I mean, those mundane things that are going on in the world right now. I mean, I'm still having difficulty with the computer. I'm amazed the few times that I've turned it on. And it worked. And you get all sorts of information, and you get emails that you don't want to listen to, read, or respond to. Something that seems to be illogical. But the moment that you, in fact, experience it and see it, then you have to go back and reassess. So he says, the scientists develop their theories based on logic and also dismiss various phenomena as being impossible based on logic. But if you demonstrate to them empirically that something they previously dismissed actually exists, they are forced to revise their theories and find a way to explain the new phenomenon based on the stars or nature, because ultimately you cannot deny your eyes. You can't deny it. In your case, however, you have not shown me any physical evidence to substantiate your beliefs. You hear what he's telling the Christian? Everything you tell me is something that I have to accept on faith. You can't prove anything. It's impossible to prove anything. There was nobody there when Jesus came back to life. We certainly hope there was nobody there when somebody or other impregnated Mary. Nobody knows. Nobody can prove it. So on what basis am I going to accept this? I'm going to have to accept this on the basis of faith, because you cannot demonstrate it to me. So why should I accept that faith? Furthermore, what you suggest is totally foreign to me. I was not raised with these ideas. And so I need to search more thoroughly until I find the truth. Somebody was not raised with the idea that there's a Father, a Son, and a Holy Ghost, and there's a virgin birth. I mean, these are all ideas that simply can't be proved. Well, I need another few minutes, just another few minutes, because I want to finish Christ's sake, right? We have to pass that stage. I can't accept it. Afterwards, the Khusri called for a wise Muslim and asked him about his ideas and practices. And he's going to really express one idea. The Muslim says that he believes everything that it says in Torah, because we know all of that to be true. But then came the last and the greatest prophet of them all, Mohammed. Now it seems, I'm not an Islamic scholar, but it seems the great proof of the truthfulness of Islam is that there is no book that was ever written in all of history like the Quran. The Quran is so unique, it's so unusual, it's so divine. No human being could ever have written it. Muhammad had to have written it because it was dictated to him from heaven. The king of the Khazars is going to reject this. He says, listen, I don't speak Arabic. I don't know Arabic. I have absolutely no way of knowing if this is the greatest book that was ever written. This is also to him absolutely foreign. Absolutely foreign.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Can I just say that Muhammad was illiterate, so even dictated he couldn't have written.
That's very...
He was illiterate.
The Rambam refers to him as Hamishugah Hazeh. And that is because I think he was an epileptic. So that he did have all sorts of epileptic seizures.
Good.
Now, so in number six, the the Khusri begins to reject the idea that was expressed by the Muslim. You know, you can fill in and read on your own. Thank God it's in English. In number 7, the wise Muslim responded, "Our Prophet did perform great miracles." It seems the king of the Khazars said, "You know, did he ever perform miracles?" However, an account of these miracles is never deemed necessary for acceptance of our religion. All right, what number are we up to?
8 is very good.
Number 8, we're just going to have to do number 8. You know what? No, do number 8 later. I'll take it to number 10. Number 10, page 44. And this will set the stage for our next year. By the way, I do have homework for you. I'd like you to read the introduction. There's a very good introduction. Now, the fact is, there may be some parts of the introduction that you will not fully comprehend because you'll be able to understand. You're smart.
That's right.
You're smart.
Right.
It's going to be a brief form, some of the major ideas. Some of them you will already begin to identify. Read that. And also, I gave you that I handed out last week. There was one page in English. Read that too. It's going to give you a great deal of information. So take me now to number 10. I see myself compelled to ask the Jews, because they are the relic of the children of Israel. Both the Christian and Muslim had based everything on the Jews who came before them. For I see that they constitute in themselves the evidence for the divine law on earth. He then invited the Jewish rabbi.
I'm glad.
Could there be a non-Jewish rabbi? He invited a rabbi and asked him about his belief. And here we're going to begin an amazing journey. And in this journey, there are going to be parshiyot and Torah that are going to be explained, mitzvahs that are going to be elaborated on. There are going to be a lot of fascinating things. We're going to pull out each one of these fascinating things. Yes.